Bienvenue au train des yeux. Nous sommes ici à jouer au basketball. Il va vous conduire à la victoire. Car bonne dans notre grand départ. Et l'esprit du bel an qui vit en tous les mans. Et l'esprit qui ne meurt jamais. Parce que basketball, oui, basketball a arrivé.
Jouer.
Welcome to BizCast Ball, the Basketball BizCast. My name is Corbin Smith. Exciting episode today because I have abandoned the NBA. I'm done with it. It's over for me. This, everything I'm producing right now, is about the Chinese Basketball Association. And I'll tell you why. Because I spoke to Andrew Crawford, the proprietor of Sharkfin Hoops, an English language Chinese Basketball Association blog. And he told me everything about the league, and I'm hooked! It's the only thing I'm interested in now. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at Shoulders Galore. He's got a lot of thoughts on what's going on over in China. And I talked to him about the league and the way it's run and the style of play and things of that nature. I think you'll really enjoy it. All right, I'm here with Andrew Crawford. Andrew is the proprietor of Sharkfin Hoops. He's also written for The Classical and some other places. How are you doing today, Andrew?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Philadelphia is a tiny bit cold, but, you know, other than that, everything's pretty good.
I live a cold lifestyle out here in the Pacific Northwest. You don't need to tell me about the cold there.
I don't know, man. I'm from England, and everyone has this idea that, England, it must be really cold. It's actually just wet. So when you expose British people to, like, actual cold, we kind of have a mental meltdown, as you just heard.
You know what? I actually think that probably comes closer to describing PNW. Although lately, last few years, it's just been... So, Andrew, you write Sharkfin Hoops, which is about the Chinese Basketball Association. Is this correct?
Mm-hmm. It is correct.
The Chinese Basketball Association, I think, is being sort of more front and center in people's minds, especially this year, I think, with Mudiay going to the CBA and Jordan Crawford. To the best of my knowledge, you broke the... Jordan Crawford to China news. Congratulations.
I mean, I was unaware of that, but I'll gladly take all the credit for that.
To the best of my... You were the first person on my timeline who had Jordan Crawford to China. I'm just throwing this out there.
That's good. Look, I'm all about taking credit for other people's work, so I'll do that.
All right. So, it's more present. Andre Blatch, some NBA players, World Peace... The once and forever Ron Artest is playing in China currently, so it's a hoppin' thing. So what is the CBA like?
In terms of like a league, it's pretty crazy, you know, and I think it's done well to become more and more sort of normal, but it's still definitely got a strange vibe to it. So you've got... Obviously, China is a country that is crazy about basketball, and yet it has probably one of the most dysfunctional basketball leagues or sort of sporting leagues you're ever going to see.
There's a thing, I think, with maybe a certain type of basketballer every year. So I write about the Trailblazers quite a bit, and this summer we have summer league out here, you know, and... out here, you live in Philadelphia. We have summer league, and you go and you look up a guy's stats. So I'm looking up. So this year on our summer league team, we have Bobby Brown. Is that his name? Chinese played in the CBA. And I
Bobby Brown plays at Dongguan.
Yes, and I'm looking at Bobby Brown's stats because I don't know. I'm writing about him because he's on the summer league team. And I see that he scored like 30 points a game in China. Now, Bobby Brown is like not an NBA player. But even if like players who go out to play in Europe, they don't put up 30 points. Do they? What I'm trying to get at is, are they playing at like this insane, crazy pace? Or what's going on?
Okay, so I think there are various things. I think, first of all, it's important to stress that at any CBA game, there are probably maybe 1,000 guys in the stand that can play better perimeter defense than your average Chinese guard. And that's not because they're bad at it. It's more that Chinese basketball just seems to be geared around getting, you know, if they score, that's fine. Just get the ball back up the other end. It's very much a league which is driven, you know, driven by offense rather than defense. The Bobby Brown thing is very interesting. So I talked about before we started recording this that there's different teams who play different ways, and Bobby Brown plays with Dongguan, and Dongguan have kind of solved the riddle about being a small market team in China, but also being, you know, a perennial playoff team. And what they've done is basically created an offense which is fundamentally based around shoot first guards. And that system gives the point guard, who's often an American, the greenest light you're ever going to see in basketball. So Bobby Brown can take 30 shots a game. And because defense is so bad in Chinese basketball, more often than not, he's going to be able to get his shot. And that's why you're seeing such, you know, huge points on various people's box scores, just because these players are given all the shots they want, for lack of a better word. Like, defense is not existent.
So in China, the money ball strategy is hand the ball to a high usage guard and just have him crush the inferior defense in front of him.
Basically, you have to remember, I was actually a beat writer in China during the J.R. Smith years. I think they hadn't invented a number for the amount of shots he was taking. It was just off the charts.
So you were covering the team that J.R. played on?
No, I was covering Yao Ming's team. I was living in Shanghai, and I covered the Shanghai Sharks, which is the team Yao Ming played for as a kid before he moved to Houston in, I want to say, was it 2002?
Unless I'm mistaken, he currently owns the team.
He does, yes. So he came back. So Shanghai were in massive financial issues. And Yao bought the team in 2009. And when he retired in 2010, he basically came back. He attends every game. He sometimes comes and works, watches the coaches train the players. He's very, very hands-on. That's Shanghai. J.R. Smith was playing for this very random small market team in Zhejiang province. And they pretty much didn't have any perimeter players at all. So they just let J.R. Smith take as many shots as he wanted, which is why he averaged over 33 points a game that year.
So, but is this endemic throughout the entire league? American guards just getting up tons of obscene shots. What is Jordan Crawford like in China?
Well, Jordan Crawford may actually be cut.
Oh my god!
This is the problem. So the thing is, like, as a Chinese, as an import into Chinese basketball, your number one responsibility is to shoot as often as you want and make sure, you know, you keep on making the shots. If you're ill or you can't make shots, then you have no logical use in Chinese basketball. Jordan Crawford right now has a pretty severe eye injury, which is why Sebastian Telfair is playing for his team right now instead. But you will see a lot of American guards just go over there and put up crazy numbers. So if right now in the scoring charts in the CBA, I think the leading scorer is averaging 41 points a game, and he was a shoot first point guard from a Division II team that played in second division Israeli basketball. But because his team realized that this is a player that can just keep on scoring, he can get hot really quickly, that's the one skill you need in Chinese basketball as an overseas player. So, you know, he's instantly productive in China. I think the second highest scorer right now is Dominique Jones. Remember him from Dallas? He's averaging like 38 points a game. So basically the fundamental goal here is to shoot as often as you can and that the Chinese players collect the rebounds, which isn't great. And that's kind of why the Chinese national team is struggling, just because after years and years of this, it's kind of creating players who don't know how to take the shots themselves. But as an American, oh yeah, if you're a gunner, it must be paradise.
I was going to talk about this a little later, but let's get to it now. The Chinese national team befuddles me, because And I think befuddles anybody who looks at it, because I've grown under the assumption that the Chinese like is it the most popular sport in China? That's a thing, right?
Yeah, I would say it's between that and soccer.
Unless I'm mistaken, Mao approved of the game when he implicitly disapproved of basically every other sport. It has a lot to do. It's like pretty hard grained into Chinese culture. So I don't. It's sort of weirds me out that the Chinese national team, which is a country with two billion people right now, right?
There's a lot of people.
Yeah. A country of 2 billion people, the largest country on Earth, where basketball is the most popular sport, fields a national team that loses to Iran in Asia Basket.
Don't forget India. It lost to India recently as well.
Haddadi's a good player. Haddadi's in China right now, actually, unless I'm mistaken.
He is. He had a triple-double last night.
Yeah, Haddadi, some passing skills. It's even in Asia Basket, that's the case. But why are they not good? Like, it's a huge country where people like basketball. Why is the team not good at all?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons, and you know, this is not like official. This is not official backed up. You know, reasoning here. This is just my scorching hot takes.
Please, I want to hear every take.
So I'll fire away with my hot takes. I think, first of all, the coaching is still fundamentally flawed. I think there's still not a lot of progressive coaching going on. I still think you can observe some coaching, and you can sort of it was probably the same as it was in the 1950s. So there does need to be like a fundamental overhaul of how players are coached, particularly guards.
What is the coaching ethic like?
It's basically trained for 6 to 8 hours a day. It's very sort of based around repetitions, which is why I would argue that Chinese basketball, the local players are fundamentally sound. They could knock down a jump shot with the lights out. But what is going to cause them problems is that because there is this, you know, this almost rote learning of basketball, there isn't the ability to sort of adjust on the fly. You know, these players aren't learning through trial and error. They're just learning in a very sanitized environment. So they're not kind of used to figuring stuff out for themselves, I would argue. And I think that, you know, that catches up with them on the world stage, where, like, not just when you're playing against the Americans or Spain or France or you know, a relatively strong international team, even someone like Iran, their players are allowed to learn how to play basketball in a more organic environment, whereas in China it's a lot more sanitized.
And what else we got? What are the other reasons why Chinese international basketball hasn't taken off the way I think people probably thought it would?
Well, I think also like the selection policy is still fundamentally flawed. So obviously the Jeremy Lin phenomenon is at its greatest in China, but there's this, you know, there's the irony basically that a Jeremy Lin would not come out of the mainland, because how they select players is still fundamentally geared around being tall and other random criteria that the system doesn't really find good basketball players. It just finds very tall athletes, and I think you're seeing so many basketball players that just go unnoticed because they don't correspond with certain Chinese metric tests, and I think that's a big issue as well. I think there's still a misunderstanding about strength and nutritioning, and also just, you know, they train so much that I just think you're just grinding players down before they've even had a chance to grow into their bodies. So I think basically the reason, you know, my opinion at least anyway, the reason why Chinese basketball is not as strong as it should be is because of they're not finding the right players. They're not allowing them to learn in an environment that doesn't end with your coach screaming at you if you make a mistake. So it's kind of like a soulless environment right now, and I think China's got to work out how they're going to change that.
And so in the CBA right now, the structure has become that there are skill. What I'm picking up from this, tell me if I'm wrong, is that the structure is that there are American guards who shoot a lot, and they're paired up with Chinese big men who have sort of repetitive type skill. Is that what's going on in the league right now?
Well, what happens in China is that each team is allowed two overseas players. Some teams are allowed three for a variety of complicated reasons that we could maybe get into later. But let's just say that each team is allowed two players. So what happens is each Chinese team will go out and they'll get an American guard who can shoot, and they will get an American center who can rebound and maybe block shots as well. And, you know, he will obviously be pretty good in the low post. So basically you have your scoring covered with those two players. And you'll then find that the Chinese players at best will be relied upon to be defensive specialists or like a third or fourth scoring option on the roster. But right now there's a real issue in Chinese basketball where they're trying to figure out ways to stop, Americans just dominating the games constantly.
Why do some teams have three players? As long as you mention it.
All right, that's cool. Okay, so there is no sort of promotion or relegation in Chinese basketball, and there's also no draft. So there is no way of immediately sort of removing bad teams and bringing up sort of promising teams, emerging teams. So what happens in Chinese basketball is they have a rule where the bottom five teams in the league are allowed one extra foreign player. But the caveat to that rule is that that player has to be quote-unquote Asian. And what that now means is Middle Eastern players from Iran, Jordan, Syria, they are technically counted as Asian. So they are allowed, so teams that finished in the bottom five the previous season are allowed one extra quote-unquote Asian foreign player, which tends to be Iranian.
Is this the situation that Haddadi is in currently?
Yeah, Haddadi. Do you remember the Sixers drafted
Kazemi? I love Kazemi. Kazemi played for Oregon. He's very fun to watch.
Well, he at one point was, I think it's gone down now, but he was averaging 17 rebounds a game or something obscene like that.
He's very good. Good pick and roll defender, Kazemi. Do they play? What kind of strategies do they use out there?
Unfortunately, a lot of it is still hero ball. I think, obviously your friend and mine, Stephen Marbury, is still out there. And one of the reasons he's so good in Chinese basketball, even at 37, is because he really knows how to run the pick and roll. And he will just run the pick and roll to death against other teams. So you see a lot of pick and roll. You see a lot of hero ball. You'll see certain teams, running out specific systems. You mentioned Bobby Brown. At Dongguan, they've sort of created a system whereby the point guard is the main focal point of the attack. And he will get all the shots he needs. And then there are teams where they're really not very good at all, and their plan is, oh Christ, just give it to the American and let's see what happens. So there are differing ways of doing things, but there's not the broad gambit of tactical thinking you see in the NBA.
So there's a lot of a certain type of NBA player in the Chinese league right now. Gunnery players.
You're gonna see a lot of gunners, especially if you're bringing a guard. He's gonna be taking 25 shots a game, and that's probably in his contract. Like they will take all the shots they want. in terms of the big men, so for example, another random player who is absurdly popular in Chinese basketball. Do you remember Sheldon Williams, the guy who played for Duke?
Sort of on the Nets for a while too, maybe.
I think he was, yes. So he is out in China right now, and he's, you know, he rebounds, he blocks, he gets, 15 points a game. So you find American big men coming out there and being asked a lot of defense. So there is, there's more variety in terms of why people bring, brings American centers over. But if you're an American guard and you're coming to play in China, your only job is there. Your only job really is to score points.
Are there any American players having notable weird seasons this year?
Well, Chris Singleton is just, he's getting like 30 points, 20 rebounds, and like 5 steals, 2 blocks. He's just chipping in everywhere, so he's doing pretty well. I actually think he may end up on someone's playoff roster when he comes back, because he's been really good contributing all over the floor. I'm just trying to think anyone else who's had a pretty strong season. Bobby Brown is a very good guard in China, which may sound like a bit of an insult when you think about it, but he's doing pretty well. Jamal Franklin at Guangzhou Guangzhou Lions is doing pretty well. There's a lot of players out here I'm in Philadelphia, I'm not in China anymore. There's a lot of players out in China who are doing really well, and like they're not gonna come into the league and start, but they are, there's definitely players out here who could come and land on an NBA team and, provide 10 minutes off the bench and do really well.
Is there chafing between the Chinese style of coaching and American players who come over?
Yes. Okay. So, and again, things have changed slowly because, things have changed slowly just because you've got younger players coming in who are becoming coaches. So the sort of the old guard is getting washed away. But there are definitely issues between Chinese coaches and American players. And depending how volatile those players be, it really can decide the season. So there have been issues with American players wanting to sort of how can I put this? They don't want their lives monitored in the same way that Chinese players' lives are often controlled by the coaches. It's still very much some American players will compare playing in China to like being in the army, and I think that's a pretty fair description, and I think that can be an issue for American players sometimes.
Where did this coaching culture come from?
Where did the what culture come from?
Where did this coaching culture come from? Like, how did it develop?
Well, I think so. When China emerged after the various now we're going into a history lesson, I guess.
Please,
but
go
when
ahead.
China emerged, when China emerged from the various calamities, of the last hundred odd years, so like the Chinese Civil War, the Cultural Revolution, by the time China was readmitted into the international community, specifically with regard to sport and things like that. China really wanted to succeed internationally, doing well at the Olympics, doing well at the Asian Games, getting gold medals. It's a way for a country that China was, where it was trying to rebound from a pretty horrific century of disasters, to prove it. It still deserved to be respected. It's still a big country, it's still a proud country, it's still a historic country. And to achieve all of those things, they really knuckled down and they put a lot of pressure on their athletes to succeed. And that was often the only thing that you know, that their lives are for, essentially, if we're going to be really blunt. I think when you were enrolled at a Chinese sports school, that sport was your life. So you moved away from your family, you moved away often from your community, and you lived in a dorm with your coaches. And for maybe 51 weeks in the year, all you did was play basketball, or, you know, and you played basketball for 6, 7, 8 hours a day. So that kind of culture has existed for, you know, for decades. And in many ways, that's all China has ever known in terms of how it structures basketball. And, you know, it, those old habits are very, very difficult to change, because if you think about it, China was allowed back into the sort of the international sporting community around about the 70s. And within 20 years, they had gone from, you know, being not particularly successful in international sport to, you know, and this is within basketball, I think they won four Asian game gold medals in a row. They won a lot of FIBA titles. So in some ways, the initial success kind of reinforced the idea of creating this military-esque lifestyle for the players worked.
When did they start to tail off in success? When did it start to become maybe kind of an issue?
What do you mean? Could you say that again?
Like, when did China stop winning Asia Basket every year?
Basically, when they realized they rose the, you know, they had that golden generation of Yao Ming and Wang Shixi and Menki Batir. They rode that generation until it broke. And it's really been the last 5 years that you started to realize that, you know, the guys who've come after Yao are not as good. And that's because many of them are playing in a league where they don't have the opportunities to take the shots, then, you know, to win the game. You know, if you look at the players coming up through the league now, they're all, you know, even the best young players in China are still often the third or fourth option on their team. And, you know, because they're not getting the experience of being, you know, the guy taking the big shot, they're not getting the experience of, like, we're going to give you 25, 30 shots a game. That's giving them, you know, that's giving them enormous problems in the international stage.
Does this intensive training make Chinese players more injury prone?
I think so. I mean, I don't have any data in front of me. I would be amazed if it wasn't. Like, just the simple biological fact of, if you make a 7-foot man exercise for 8 hours a day, that's going to grind down his already, you know, his already misshapen body, for lack of a better word. I don't think, and, you know, I think Yao Ming, you know, again, this is just my own scorching hot take. I wonder if Yao Ming had grown up in a country where they hadn't, you know, they hadn't made him train 6 to 8 hours a day, whether, you know, he would have suffered those injuries as early as he did in his career.
Are there, you mentioned younger players, are there any younger players who could have their eyes on the NBA?
I think Wang Zilin, who I think you mentioned you saw in Portland.
Yes,
Nike Hoop Summit.
I've seen Wang play in Portland. I believe I saw him block Nerlens Noel at the rim, if I remember correctly.
Nice. Well, yeah. He's pretty good. So he's currently in his third year as a professional. And even before he made his debut, everyone was talking about him in terms of, like, he's the next Yao, you know, he's the next, you know, whatever. He's a future Chinese superstar. He was for the 2012 Olympics. He was almost selected for the national team before he'd even played a professional game. That was how good people thought he could be, you know. And 3 years in, he's doing okay. I think defensively, he's not the best, but, you know, he's 7 foot two, he's 240 pounds.
He's very big, very big unit. And
he's very confident bashing and crashing down low. Now, the irony is he's still a back to the basket player wanting to eventually come to the NBA, where back to the basket centers are a dying breed. So, you know, we'll see what happens. There is one other player, Zhu Qiu, who made his debut this year. He's 17. No one's probably going to hear about him for another 3 or 4 years, but he's a very promising player. The problem is, though, that, you know, these two players I've listed are both centers, and I think this kind of confirms the problem that China has with coaching up guards, in that all of the players that have eventually made it to the NBA are all centers, with the exception of Sun Yu, who I think played for the Lakers in 2008, and he was a point guard, but he was a 6'9" point guard. So, you know, if you're going to be hearing about a player from China in the next few years, it's probably going to be a large one. And I think that's also going to hold China back, and that they're not producing smaller players. It's only big, large brutes.
Lin is a big deal in China still?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Jeremy Lin is an American. He's very American. He attended Harvard. He's a born-again Christian, and he's pretty open and active and loud about that. I believe he's done rallies in Taiwan and things of that nature. Is there, like, a dissonance between that and the sort of... I mean, China's a relatively atheistic culture. Is there, like, a... Is that weird?
Well, I think I have to tread light on this one because, okay. You know, as a white dude, I don't think I want to sort of speak for the whole, you know, the whole of China. But I think what Jeremy Lin is for the mainland is he's very much like an aspirational figure. Like, here is a guy who went to a good school. You know, obviously China is very, very, you know, is very much into, you know, like all Asian countries and all Asian cultures, you know, like going to a good university is something to aspire to. So Jeremy Lin is, you know, he went to Harvard. Everyone knows what Harvard is. You know, he's the same height as many of the people who wear his jersey, which is a refreshing take in China. Like, you know, they've had 10 years of Yao Ming and Wang Zhixi, these 7-foot giants. So there's definitely this idea that Jeremy Lin at 6'3" is a lot more, literally he's a lot more physically relatable. And also, I just think the nature of Chinese culture is that within the Chinese diaspora, I think whether you're Chinese American, whether you're Taiwanese, whether you're Hong Kong, whether you're a mainlander, I think that, you know, there is definitely an idea within the mainland, certainly, that, you know, regardless of where you are in the world, you know, your Chinese culture still links you to the mainland. So I think that's still a very powerful thing for him.
Is there a sense, do you think, that China is on their way to fixing their guard problem?
No. I honestly think it's going to take 20 years. And I think there are, like, Yao Ming, for example, is something of a modernist in Chinese basketball. And because of his status and his stature within the league, people do listen to him. But it's still very, very difficult to coach guards just because of the environment, you know, just because of the environment that they are coached in, which is an example that does not allow mistakes to be made, that does not sort of encourage individualism. If you're going to be a guard, particularly a point guard, you've got to be willing to, you know, think outside the box. You've got to be able to, like, fix a solution in 3 or 4 different ways. And I don't think the Chinese coaching culture right now is conducive to doing that.
Who owns and operates CBA teams?
Okay, well, it really depends. So obviously, within the mainland, there's still a very complicated relationship between, you know, public and private property, public and private businesses, et cetera, et cetera. Yao Ming, for example, owns the Shanghai Sharks, and many of the teams in China are owned by individuals. And you will find a lot of sort of private funding coming in from various public and private companies. So it's a very complicated setup, and I don't think there are people who own CBA teams who are entirely sure of who else owns a CBA team. It's very complicated.
The government operates the league, right?
Yes, they do.
How does that affect league operations?
Well, I mean, in what sense?
I don't know. The CBA proper,
yes,
as operated by the government, what are their goals?
Well, I think, again, this is just my own scorching hot take. I think it really depends on what part of China you're in. So Chinese basketball is still largely dependent on its provincial coaching setups. So whilst technically, Chinese Basketball Federation in Beijing is technically in charge, I feel that, on a province by province level, those are the people who are largely in charge. So the CBA has overall authority, but a lot of power is still used and deployed by sports bureaus on a province by province level.
What is a sports bureau?
In each province, and now I'm starting to step beyond my expertise, so you may actually have to edit this out in case I get it wrong. My understanding of the sports, each province in China, so there's several different provinces in China. Each province has a semi-autonomous sports bureau that's in charge of orchestrating its sport. So not just in basketball and soccer, in track and field and gymnastics, each province has a sports bureau, which are in charge of the coaching and, just the general cultivation of its sporting talent. Now, obviously they, as I understand it, they have a certain degree of influence within teams in their, within their sort of province. So, many of the players that come to, many of the local players that come into CBA teams come from the sports schools within that province, which are run by the individual sports bureaus. So I think that's the sort of influence I'm talking about.
So they kind of interact and coexist as entities?
I believe so. It's one of these things where, like, I think very few people are entirely sure what happens because, and now we're getting into these very, very complicated situations about, the very, like, bureaucratic nature of China. But different provinces have different relationships with their CBA team. It's a very complicated, very bureaucratic system within a very vast country.
I want to ask about Mudiay real quick. Top NBA prospect played in China this year. Is injured right now, I think.
Yes.
Is it year ending injury or just kind of sidelined?
No. What happened is he has some kind of injury to his right knee, I believe. Basically, Guangdong, who are the team signed him. Guangdong are basically, I would say, like the Spurs of the Chinese basketball. They're very, very successful. They've won, I think, 8 CBA titles in the last 12 years. They're very, very well run. And they made the decision that they were not going to rush Mudiay back, which is why there was a flurry of reports in the last few days that that Guangdong had cut him. Guangdong haven't cut him. They are keeping him around to make sure he is basically especially fit. They don't want to risk another injury because if you do lose that American player, you're really screwed.
Because you can't sign another American player.
You can in theory, but like it's more, you can't, it's one thing to have a player who's got used to the team over the length of a season. You don't want to throw someone in straight away and hope that they can do well.
When Guangdong signed Mudiay, was it just that they thought he was good, or was there a sort of extraneous circumstance around that?
Well, I think the reason why Guangdong signed Mudiay was Mudiay was a very, very unique talent, and he was very useful for Guangdong. So Guangdong, you know, very much like the Spurs in that they have three or four excellent Chinese players. You know, they, you know, the backbone of the national team for several years. And Guangdong used that group of four players, group of five players maybe, to win, you know, several CBA titles. The problem is that those players got old and they're all in their sort of early 30s now. So it's one of those things where Guangdong needed to get younger, and suddenly you find this potential top three pick in the NBA draft who's suddenly ineligible for the NCAA. So they thought, okay, we can put this guy in and he can give us the youth and creativity we need when our older proven veterans get tired. So it's a great mix. You know, for Guangdong, it was a great mix of sort of youth and experience, basically.
Did Guangdong luck into good players, or do they do something different development-wise?
Development-wise, they're very careful with their coaching. So, for example, there are teams within China who will drop everything if they can get a particularly good American player. And that means that, you know, the young, talented Chinese player who was occupying that position previously now gets kicked to the side to accommodate the American who at this point in his career is better than the young Chinese player. But ultimately, if that young Chinese player was able to get the playing time, he probably would be just as good. Whereas Guangdong have consistently stuck to a formula of like, we play our Chinese players 35 minutes, and the Americans are there to rebound and do the defensive work, and it's our Chinese players will win the games. And they use that system to be they use that system really well, because you're only allowed Americans on the court for a certain amount of quarters, which means when the Americans are off the court, a team is at a disadvantage, whereas Guangdong never had that disadvantage.
What do you mean a certain amount of quarters?
Within the CBA, you are allowed to play the foreign players for a combined 8 quarters. So in the past, that would mean that each player would get, was it 8 or 6? Oh, sorry, 1 second. So basically how it worked out was that each CBA team who had two foreign players would play one of their Americans in the first quarter, they would play one of their Americans in the second quarter, and then they would play both their Americans for the whole of the second half. And if you were a team that had a third Asian import, that player could play without any restrictions. So as you can see, this is kind of complicated. Guangdong actually get around those rule changes by basically creating as many confident, capable Chinese players as they could, and therefore they were able to get around the import restrictions.
Are teams miffed at these restrictions? Like, is it annoying to them that they pay a foreign player so much money and they can only utilize them here and there?
Yes, would be. I mean, in an ideal world, they would. You know, if when Zhejiang had J.R. Smith, in an ideal world, they would have played him 48 minutes and just let him, you know, take 60 shots a game. Unfortunately, there are, you know, the CBA, you know, for all the complicated, fragmented politics within Chinese sport, the CBA still has the final say on how the rules are going to get, you know, written and how they're going to be enforced. So whilst there is grumbling, I think people kind of have to accept that that's the way it's also going to be. And also there's like the patriotic element to these things. You know, Chinese fans want to come to a CBA game and see Chinese players. So CBA teams are kind of backed up against the wall, because obviously they don't want to say we just want to play Americans the whole time. And the CBA knows this. So there's kind of a quiet acceptance that if they had their way, CBA teams would play their Americans the whole time. Whereas, you know, but at the same time, sorry, they can't come out and say that. And the league knows this, so it's gradually creating an environment where Chinese players are being more and more involved in games. They brought in a rule this year which said you're only allowed to play one American in the fourth quarter rather than two, as it had been for the last few years. And the reason why they'd done that is because during the fourth quarter, the two Americans would just take over the game. But now the idea is, well, if we only have one American player on the court the whole time, that means we have to involve the Chinese players more.
Okay. Wow, okay. I mean, I know that's a thing in the PBA, too, the Filipino league, too.
Yes.
That they can only have one American player, but they don't. Boy, I don't think they have those kinds of weird arcane restrictions. All right. I have... Oh, my God. Okay. Do American sneaker companies operate in China?
Yes. So, again, this is also another complicated part of Chinese basketball. So, the original sponsors of the CBA were Nike. The original sponsor of the CBA was Nike, and in recent years Chinese shoe wear have tried to edge Nike out the market. So, for example, Nike no longer sponsor the CBA. That is, they are sponsored instead by Li Ning, who I think actually sponsored Dwyane Wade as well.
Yes, they do.
And part of Li Ning's deal with the CBA was that every single player in the league had to wear their shoes. So whilst you do see American brands there, there's a very aggressive push by Chinese brands to kind of push the American shoe wear brands out the limelight.
So players can't sign endorsement deals or anything?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, it's kind of, so like, for example, Yi Jin Lian is a Nike guy, without trying to sound too Darren Rovell. He is a Nike guy, but he cannot wear his shoes in CBA competition because Li Ning control they have brand exclusivity within the league. So Nike works really hard to sign Chinese athletes, Chinese basketball players to their brand, but within the CBA itself, it's very difficult for them to get any kind of exposure.
Is the way the CBA operates indicative of the way things in China operate, or is it?
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
100%. Like, as I think I've tried to get across, everything is very bureaucratic. Everything is very convoluted. There's a lot of behind the scenes agreements. It's a very complicated. It's a very complicated system, and I would like to say I know a pretty, you know, a lot about Chinese basketball by, you know, the standards of Western journalists, but I think I'm maybe only scratching 5% of the surface. There's so, you know, everything is very complicated, and everything is very bureaucratic and sort of managed on a province level, and, you know, it can be very difficult to keep up with everything.
How did you get into this?
Sure. So I was, I used to be a high school teacher. I left England after I graduated teaching college. And, you know, this is a long story, but it'll be worth it, I hope. So I graduated teaching college and I moved to Kenya in East Africa for a while. And I taught there at the international school. And whilst I was there, I ended up getting work with a professional soccer team there. And, you know, that was pretty cool in that it sort of exposed me to, you know, different kinds of journalism, different kinds of deadlines, writing different styles and so on and so forth. It just really boosted my confidence. So after I left Kenya, when, you know, things started to get pretty dangerous there, as you can probably see on the news, I moved to China to work in a school there. And, China was a bit of a culture shock. And one of the ways I got used to living in China was I wrote a blog. I wrote a blog about the Shanghai team, and you know, someone noticed, and one thing led to another, and I began writing for the English language newspaper there, the Shanghai Daily. And you know, then after that I got a press pass, and you know, I spent 2 years following the team, reporting on the team. And you know, that was pretty cool. I was there during the J.R. Smith, Kenyon Martin, Wilson Chandler season, and then I was there for when Gilbert Arenas was in Shanghai, and that was pretty cool, just meeting Gilbert Arenas and trying to make sense of his, you know, always interesting world. And just since then I've been writing about Chinese basketball because it's, you know, it's become a legitimate passion of mine.
What is the strangest thing that you witnessed while you were covering the Sharks?
There's unfortunately a lot, which is could take up a lot of your time.
Please take up my time.
I think the one that leaps out to me was when Gilbert Arenas was with the team. He decided he was going to give free tickets. I think I want to say 300 tickets. And you know, Shanghai play in a very small arena, so that's like a substantial amount. So he gave away a lot of tickets, several hundred tickets, to people who followed him on the Chinese equivalent of Facebook.
A Weibo. And, is that what it's called?
A Weibo, yes. So he gave away several hundred tickets to his Weibo followers, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, so, you know, bumper crowd. And as has been a longstanding problem in China, the referees were terrible. And they basically screwed up the game. And Shanghai ended up losing, at which point the bumper crowd that Gilbert Arenas had helped bring in started heckling the referees, at which point the referees started heckling the crowd back, at which point the crowd decided to start throwing fast food, you know, KFC at the referees, et cetera, et cetera. And in the meantime, the press row is in the middle of these fans just throwing chicken legs and popcorn and whatever else they could, you know, lay their hands on. And I'm sitting there wondering, oh God, am I going to get out of this? And, you know, it all just calmed down, but I can, you know, I still have fond memories of the time Gilbert Arenas almost helped spark a stadium riot.
Andrew, thank you so much for talking to me today. I don't know if I understand Chinese basketball anymore, but I feel like I know more about it, certainly.
Thank you. No, it's no problem at all, man. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Thank you once again to Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at Shoulders Galore or follow his blog, Sharkfin Hoops, at Sharkfin Hoops. You can follow me on Twitter at Corbin A. Smith, where you can find out about what I'm writing on any given day. Hey, if you listen to us on iTunes, rate and review. The HP network on iTunes gets our iTunes ranking up so we can trick more people into listening to this thing. Thank you for listening this week. Our outro music this week is The Carter Family. Thank you for listening. The road.
to cherish me over all others above. How my heart feels that wandering no misery can tell. He's left me no warning, no words of farewell. Loud.